A number of years ago, I heard a preacher say, I always have felt sorry for the front pew and the third verse of the songs because we hardly ever use them. And tonight we sang verse 3 of Give Me the Bible. I don't know when I'd sung verse 3 of that song in a long, long time. And that's great. That's good. I'm trying to figure out who all are visitors and who are not. And I think I see some that would be considered visitors. And I want you to know I'm glad not just you, but everyone that chose to be here tonight. I hope we'll have some things to say that will be beneficial for us. And I know our worshiping God together has made it worthwhile as well. And I said earlier, I do appreciate you've got a number of men here who are able to take care of a job that I'm not very good at, and that is leading singing. I told somebody Sunday as we were eating lunch together that I always say if the word got out that someone was in town shooting song leaders, I wouldn't hide. I would feel perfectly safe, but it's good that we do have men that can and will do that work. Probably most of you are aware of the fact that we've announced ahead of time that tonight we're going to talk about Bible fools. Now, I want to sort of preface that lesson by making a little bit of an observation about the word fool itself as it relates to the Bible. I can remember when I was much younger, I don't think it was my parents, but there were some who had sort of communicated me to the idea that there's something special taboo about the word fool, and we ought to be careful that we don't ever use that word. And obviously, in our lesson tonight, we're going to see that the Bible does indeed use that word and applies it to certain individuals. And so the question arises about when it would be proper or improper to refer to someone as a fool. And with that having been said, I want us to notice the verse that I suspect gave rise to that idea about the word fool itself being some sort of a special forbidden word to use. Of course, this is in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus is warning here. He says, you heard that was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. And then as he does several times in this context, he said then, but I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. Now notice, but whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Well, that would certainly make us think that this is something very serious that we need to be very cautious about. That Jesus said, if whatever it is Jesus is referring to here in calling someone a fool or saying, thou fool, it would endanger one's eternal soul salvation. But let me also remind you on another occasion, as it's recorded in Matthew 23, this is that passage in which Jesus is really giving an excoriating condemnation to a number of practices among the Jews, the Jewish leaders in particular. And he's dealing here with this abuse of the oaths and how it had come to be. There was this carefully constructed theory about certain oaths were binding and certain oaths were not. We're not going to get into all that tonight. But as he addresses that false concept, he says, you fools and blind, whether it's greater, the gold, or the temple that sanctifieth the gold, which the point was, if you swear by the gold or by the temple. Point I want us to think about is, don't we here have Jesus calling someone a fool? And the question is, did Jesus violate his own prohibition? Did Jesus say one time, you should never ever say that someone is a fool, and yet then he turns around himself and accuses some of being fools? Let's notice those two words back there in Matthew 5. Some pronounce it Raca, some say Raca. I don't know how the people of Jesus' day would have pronounced it. But we're told by those who know this was probably an Aramaic word, the language that Palestinian Jews spoke. It was a term of reproach, but it would be today sort of, as we would talk about someone being empty-headed or senseless, it was an expression of scorn or contempt for a person's intellect. Can you think of all the words we have in our vocabulary that would express that idea? There's a lot of them. And same thing with this word fool. This is the Greek word, moros, which is a term of reproach. It means morally worthless. And so this now is expressing scorn or contempt for a person's character. But I would suggest to you that there, again, are many words And we could probably put a long list together, if we put our heads together, of words that we use in English to express either of these two concepts of railing, reviling. This is what the Bible calls railing, to speak in a defamatory, injurious way, either about a person's intellect or their character, in a malicious way. That's what Jesus is talking about. So having said that, we're going to notice now, we'll spend a lot of our time tonight, as you may have already suspected, in the book of Proverbs. Because the book of Proverbs is constantly talking about what's wisdom versus what is folly. The wise person and the fool. It's not speaking in contemptuous terms, as Jesus was talking about here, but it's simply pointing out ways of thinking and ways of acting that are foolish. And I feel like I'm safe in saying there's not a person here, probably not any right-thinking person anywhere, that wants to be a fool or be thought a fool or be called a fool in the sense that you're doing something that just is ridiculously inane and foolish. So that's what we're going to be thinking about tonight, the way in which the Bible calls people. Clearly the Bible on many occasions, as we'll see tonight, says if you are acting or thinking or speaking in a certain fashion, then you're a fool. And what I want us to take away from this lesson is, as we look at each of these, just ask ourselves the question, is that ever characteristic of me? If so, I'm a fool. And if you're familiar at all with the Bible in general, but with the book of Proverbs, what it's saying is don't be this way. Don't be a fool. It's very serious. All right, let's look at some of them. First one we'll look at is in Psalm 14 and verse 1. And actually this exact same statement is found over in Psalm 53, I think, in verse 1. And it simply says this, "The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God." We talked about this a little bit, didn't we, on Sunday? No, I never can remember Monday and Sunday. It was Monday night. Monday night we talked about knowing God and how God has given us sufficient, compelling evidence to believe in his existence. So we've already kind of touched on this and just sort of remind you of what we were noticing in that lesson Monday night, that through God's creation and through his word and through Jesus himself, he has given us abundant evidence to believe that God does exist. And yet there are people who say there is no God. That's the atheist, of course. And some of us were talking, I think, Sunday afternoon about how sometimes when you really challenge an atheist about what he believes, he will quickly become an agnostic and say, well, I just don't know. Or there's not sufficient evidence to be sure whether God exists or not. But there's not that much difference. In the face of the fact that the evidence is right in front of us to prove to us there is, notice as we talked about the other night, an intelligent design clearly implies an intelligent designer. So we're not going to go back over all of that. But here's the writer of the psalm saying that anyone with that kind of evidence who says there's no God, and some think maybe the emphasis here is on the fact that I'm going to act as if I just don't acknowledge God and he doesn't observe my life. But in any way you look at it, they're a fool. Now, let's notice here, would you say tonight that anybody who either questions or denies the existence of God is of inferior intelligence? Or uneducated? Well, that's just not the case. There are many, many examples that could be given of a person who, the way we measure intelligence, would be an intelligent, smart person, and who maybe has a whole string of degrees behind their name. Let me give you just one example that I think is a classic. Bertrand Russell was a British philosopher and mathematician, and those who really knew his achievements were in awe almost of this man's intellect and of his education. He once gave a series of lectures. He was a Nobel Prize winner also, but he delivered a lecture in London, England one time entitled, "Why I Am Not a Christian." So not only was he not a Christian, but at one point in Bertrand Russell's life, he said, "I could call myself an agnostic, but I'm really an atheist." So he acknowledged that he was an atheist. Well, someone once asked Bertrand Russell, "If you should discover someday that in fact God does exist, and you're standing before that God, and he's going to judge you for your life, what would you say to him?" You know what Bertrand Russell said? He said, "I should reproach him for not giving us enough evidence." I think I can say, I think here the scripture before us is saying, that intelligent, highly educated man of great accomplishments was a fool because he's saying there's not enough evidence. Do you remember what we saw in Romans 1 the other night? When Paul talks about the fact that God's eternal power and Godhead are clearly seen by the things that are made so that they are without excuse. There's no excuse for a person to question whether or not there is a creator, sovereign God over the universe. And as I mentioned the other night, there's a whole host of people who have been great achievers and are highly intelligent, who would honestly weigh the evidence and reach the conclusion, as the rocket scientist said, there must be a creator, there can be no other way. And as I mentioned briefly the other night, I'll just mention it again, there are, I think, a lot of people whose eyes are beginning at least to be opened up to the fact that you cannot explain what we observe in the universe as just being the product of random chance. I like the way one man described that. A person, and you can see the folly of this whole concept. He said the idea that the universe as we see it now, with its complexity, whether you're talking about the human body or the stars or subatomic particles, all of those things together, that just all happened by sheer random chance. And his explanation was that makes as much sense as a tornado going through a junkyard and throwing all that stuff together, and when it's through, there's a 747 jet sitting there. Well, we can say that's folly. Anybody would be a fool to think that, but there are people who are saying something much more complex than that just happened without a God to make it. So the fool that said in his heart, there is no God. Well, let's move along here. Now we'll go to the book of Proverbs. And this really sort of closely follows, if you think about it, the idea of the atheist who denies the existence of God, because what does that leave us with? Have you ever heard the phrase, man is the measure of all things? That's an old, old phrase. It goes way back to ancient Greek times. But that's the watchword of secular humanism today. And that's exactly what the book of Proverbs is talking about here in chapter 28 and verse 26. He that trusteth in his own heart is a fool. In fact, we were just talking about that tonight at the supper table, weren't we, with Joe, that people who are saying that man is capable of taking care of himself and he's self-sufficient, he doesn't need a supreme being, these same people are very often telling us, you know, we're making a mess of the planet. You ever thought about the irony of that? But that's what secular humanists say. Let me just read you a few brief snippets from the second Humanist Manifesto. There's been another one even since that one. But back in 1973, the Humanist Manifesto was put out to sort of express the philosophy. And here's what they say. I'm quoting. As non-theists, that is, not believers in God, we begin with humans, not God, with nature, not deity. Traditional faiths encourage dependence rather than independence, obedience rather than affirmation, fear rather than courage. No deity will save us, we must save ourselves. But that key phrase there, as we're looking at this here, the fool has said, I will trust in my own heart. That's what the secular humanist is saying. You people who are weak and who depend upon a God, and you have to have that as a crutch, you need to be like us and be independent. A number of years ago, Gloria Steinem, of course, she was one of the leaders of the feminist movement. She was the editor of Ms. Magazine for a long time. But she once made the statement, this again goes back before the year 2000, but they were looking forward to the coming millennium. She said, by the year 2000, I hope that we will teach our children to believe in human potential and not in God. And I can tell you, there are a lot of powerful, influential people who are espousing this kind of view. We don't need a God. They may say, well, I'm not sure if there is one or not, but I just don't even care about that because I believe in people and humans, the measure of all things. That's the person. See how old this idea is? He that trusts in his own heart. Really what the wise man says back in chapter 3 of Proverbs is turning this coin over. Look at Proverbs 3 and 5. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on thine own understanding. It's folly for a person to have such an ego to think that he's capable of doing what the prophet Jeremiah said we can't do. Maybe you're thinking of that passage, Jeremiah 10:23. O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his own steps. We need to understand that. We need to understand what Isaiah said, or really God speaking through the prophet Isaiah over there in Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. My thoughts are not your thoughts, saith the Lord, neither my ways your ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my thoughts higher than your thoughts, my ways than your ways. I love the book of Job, and we, not too long ago, studied through the book of Job back home. And you remember it toward the close of the book of Job, as Job had had these questions in his mind about what was happening in his life, and God brought him down by just propounding to him question after question after question after question. And Job had to acknowledge, I don't know. That's beyond me. That's in the realm of God's knowledge. We need to humble ourselves and realize I'm not going to trust in my own heart. If I think that way, I'm a fool. Well, let's move along. I particularly like this thought here, as it's expressed a couple of places actually in Proverbs. Back in chapter 14, verse 9, it says, fools mock at sin. They mock at sin. The other proverb is in chapter 10, 23, saying doing wrong is like a joke to a fool. You've probably thought about this before, but if you have not, think with me for a moment here about the way as Satan is so subtle, and one of his most effective weapons, I believe, is to make us laugh at sin. You ever thought about that? Let me give you an example of that one. Some of you older folks will probably relate this more quickly. You remember some of you a few years ago when there was a fad called streaking? I don't hear much about that anymore. I don't know if it still goes on or not. I see some grins out there. Well, do you remember how people were acting about that? What it was, sometimes at a football game maybe where you've got a stadium full of people, and some zany, crazy guy would take all his clothes off and run across the field. And there'd usually be cameramen there taking pictures. And then everybody would laugh, and it'd be reported. And somebody would say, well, these silly kids, they're doing all these, you know, years ago they used to see how many goldfish they could swallow. Or they used to see how many people they could cram into a phone booth. And now they hear they're streaking. And that was so funny. And we were all laughing about it. And Ray Stevens was singing a song about the streak. And I was laughing too. And then one day I said, wait a minute. That's not funny. That's sinful. The devil had us laughing and mocking and making a joke about something sinful. And that is very effective in affecting the way we view sin. How should we view sin? We're going to talk about that at length Friday night. Hope you'll come back then. But very briefly tonight, I'll just take Paul's statement. As Paul was writing to the Romans, over there in Romans chapter 12 and verse 9, Paul says, to abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. The word abhor is a strong word. Shudder at it. Hate it. There's a long poem. Some of you literary folks maybe have read it by Alexander Pope called An Essay on Man. I'm going to give you one verse out of that poem, but I think it is so expressive. Listen to it carefully. I've seen this actually in several different forms through the years. I think this is, as I'm going to read it to you now, is the way that Pope originally wrote it. He uses the word vice, which of course is his word for what we're talking about, sin, things that are wrong. Vice is a monster of so frightful mien as to be hated needs but to be seen. Yet seen too oft, familiar with her face, we first endure, then pity, then embrace. Is that not true? Sin is ugly. And when you think, as we will at length Friday night, about really the true nature of sin, the consequences of sin, it ought to be something that we would naturally shudder at and hate. But the devil can make us laugh at it and mock at it and make it entertaining. You just start watching. If you've never done it, start watching movies. Now, I know we've got some ultra-trashy movies, but you don't even have to go into those. And some TV shows, even the sitcoms, and they're filled with things that in a very subtle way will make you laugh at something that's sinful. Analyze it. Next time you're watching one of those shows. I thought I heard a noise. Not? Okay. If you find something that, when you examine it carefully, you say, that's something that the Bible condemns, but they've sugarcoated it, and they've made it entertaining, and they've made it funny. Have you ever noticed the entertainment industry and advertising in general, for that matter, sometimes using the words naughty and wicked and funny, and they just blend them together. And if we are laughing at that, is this not telling us you've been fooled? The great deceiver has fooled you. And not only is it laughing at something that's sinful, but it just sort of brings our barriers down, our defenses against it. It makes it more palatable and acceptable to us if the devil can make us laugh at it. Well, we can say more about that. Let's move on to this next one. It's back in chapter 1. Really, the writer begins with this. As you've read the book of Proverbs, you know the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge or the beginning of wisdom. That same theme comes up over and over again. But here in chapter 1, verse 7, the writer follows that with, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Maybe we should have started with this one, because it sort of is an umbrella that covers all of these. I suspect if, certainly in this audience, but probably in general around Wichita, if you would ask people, do you despise wisdom and instruction? How many yeses do you think you'd get? Probably not many, if any. No. I honor wisdom, but so we'd say it. But do we practice it? Is it something, well, how do you show that? How would you determine whether or not? Well, one of the things would be when people get together to read and study the Bible, do I want to be there and learn as much about it as I can? And do I spend much time at home? If we say that we believe that this book, the Bible, is the mind of God revealed to us, which contains all the riches of wisdom, how much time do I spend reading it and studying it? And not only that, but doing what the psalmist said. You remember the very beginning of the book of Psalms in Psalm 1? Talks there about, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of scornful. His delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. Do you do that? You see, that's a way of showing, do I really love wisdom and instruction? Where all the wisdom of the infinitely wise God is preserved for me to read it and study it. If I don't have any appreciation for that and show that by taking advantage of opportunities to learn more about it and to put it into my life, I'm a fool. It's as simple as that. Well, look here in chapter 10 again, this time verse 18. He who uttereth a slander is a fool. The word, as I understand it, the Hebrew word there just has to do with defamation, which is the way we use the word slander. The New Testament speaks repeatedly. These catalogs of sins, how many times does the word slander come up? You know, this is one of those subtle sins too. How many times have you known someone who, I'm sure it's happened, but I haven't heard it many times at all, publicly acknowledge and confess that I've been guilty of slander? It has a lot to do with our motive, and it's very similar to this. We use the word gossip very often with this same basic concept. And how will the devil deceive us? Well, he'll say, what I said was true. It may have been true. We have to be, first of all, sure that what we're saying is true, but then we've got to think about, what's my motive? And an easy examine that we can give ourselves when we're about to say something about someone else, first of all, is it true? Secondly, is my motive in saying this to hurt that person? And one way to carefully examine that is to say, would I want them to say this about me? Slander is not just bad manners. The Bible condemns it as sin. It's a serious sin, but it's a subtle sin, because we can see it in other people, but it's so hard, I think, to see this sin in ourselves. Is my motivation, my purpose in relating this, true as it may be, to defame and to hurt that person? And again, there are other places in the Proverbs where it talks about the attitude of the person who will spread the slander and gossip and who would try to hurt other people by what they say about them. Young people, listen to this next one. Two times in this chapter, the father and then the mother. A fool despiseth his father's instruction. And then in verse 20 of Proverbs 15, a foolish man despises his mother. Sometimes I think young people, maybe all of them to some degree or another, because there's so often mom and dad are telling them, no, you can't do that, no, you can't have that. Young people, have you ever even imagined something similar to this? That when you go to bed at night, mom and dad get over here and say, okay, now what will you do tomorrow to mess up their life and make them unhappy, keep them from having any fun? Well, of course, that's not true. I know there are bad parents in the world, but when I'm talking to an audience like this, I know I'm talking to people who are concerned about the welfare of their children, and especially their spiritual welfare. And so they're going to be teaching you and telling you things for your own good. But why is it that it would be foolish to not listen to and respect not just the parents, but their teaching, their instruction to you? I'll give you three reasons. We've already looked at one of them earlier this week as well. But the first reason I would give you for that is you ought to be wise in taking advantage of their experience. There's no substitute for experience. And believe it or not, your parents were one time your age. And they've experienced what it is to grow up. And probably along the way, they might have made some mistakes and they've learned some things. And now they're saying, I don't want my son or daughter to make that same mistake. I want to pass on to them the things I have learned. So that's the first thing. If you're wise, if you're not a fool, you'll think about the fact, here's two people who know some things probably that I don't know from experience. Number two, or maybe let's call that three. We're going to work our way up to that like David Letterman does. That's number three. Number two, why would it be wise to listen to those two people? Believe it or not, they love you more than anybody else in the world loves you. Sometimes you may question that and wonder about it. As you get older, you'll look back and say, yeah, they did. They really did. But combined with their experiences, they more than probably anybody on the planet want what's best for you. Now, that's number three and number two. Can you guess what number one is? We looked at Ephesians 6:1 earlier this week. Children, obey your parents and the Lord for what? This is right. I want to make a similar point when we talk about marriage. Tomorrow night, I'll just wait till we get to that, but as we're placing it here now in the realm of child and parent, there are a lot of good reasons. We haven't even covered all of them, but one of the reasons is this is God's will. He's telling you to honor and obey your parents, and if you don't, you've sinned. Probably most of the children in an audience like this at some time have had it called to their attention that under the law of Moses, now I suspect this would very often have been a rebellious child as they got older, but a child who acted not only acted foolishly, but who was disrespectful and disobedient, they could in some cases be stoned to death. And that was God's law. And that tells me this is something very serious as far as God's concerned. So a child who despises his father's instruction and despises his mother is a fool. That's a foolish way to think. And sad to say, sometimes those who do that later on in life learn that lesson and regret the mistakes that they made along that line. All right, Proverbs 29, verse 11. I can see now we're going to have to move rapidly. And I try to stay within time, so don't panic because you think, well, there's a lot more places where the Bible talks about fools. There are. We're going to get to all of them. Proverbs 29:11, it says, a fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back. That's not the King James Version. If you've got your King James Bible open, you'll notice it says, a fool uttereth all his mind. And from what I've been able to determine from the scholars and the newer translations, this is probably a better rendering. But we're going to look at one in just a moment that would cover that other idea of saying everything you think. But look at this rendering. A fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back. Loses his temper. Let me give you two other proverbs to think about, and then we'll discuss what they're saying. Proverbs 16:32 says, he that ruleth his spirit is better than he that taketh a city. And the ancients thought that's a great person who has the wisdom and the power to lead against a city and capture it. And the wise man saying here in Proverbs 16:32, if you can keep your own spirit, your temper under control, you're stronger than that man who can take a city. And the other one's in Proverbs 25:28. And this it all speaks about a city. It says, now, like a city that is broken into and without walls, is a man who has no control over his spirit. I have a very good friend in Texas, and I admire him greatly. I love him, and I think he's doing pretty good with this. But he would tell you, that's just been sort of his temperament, we call it, to lose his temper, become very angry very quickly. The Bible talks about anger and rage a lot, but it comes from this. The fool is a person who always loses his temper. You have a problem with that? Well, we all have some degree of problem with that, but some people seem like more than others. But be reminded of the fact that when you lose your temper, I think there's a very close analogy as I see it. And I don't know how this relates to the brain, but From what we know about what ethyl alcohol does to the brain, as a person begins to drink and get drunker and drunker, and it affects the parts of us that have to do with inhibitions and good judgment and self-control, I think anger and losing your temper, the effects are the same, at least. A person who normally would be soft-spoken and have good judgment and inhibitions, if they lose their temper sometimes, they're a different person. And so very often, if they're a person with a conscience, they may very quickly. You ever said something in anger and almost immediately had to apologize and realize, I shouldn't have said that. Shouldn't have done that. Happens all the time, doesn't it? And what this is saying is a fool is a person who's always losing his temper. He doesn't have the discretion to rule his own spirit and to keep from letting himself get out of control. Now let's move on to the idea of the person who talks too much. And in fact, the way the wise man says this is, as this, he's beyond being a fool. Seest thou a man that is hasty in his words? There is more hope of a fool than him. So what he's saying is, he's the worst of fools, I guess would be one way to say it. Hasty in his words. Well, James talks about let a man be slow to speak, swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. So these things kind of go together. But let's think about this for a moment. Have you ever known somebody, or have you ever been guilty of saying, well, I'll tell you this one thing. Whenever I think something, I'm going to say it. You remember Calvin and Hobbes, the comic strip? I didn't know for a long time that those were named after John Calvin and Thomas Hobbes. And so there's always, very often in that comic strip, there were some very important moral message or teaching. One of those comic strips, here's Calvin and his little tiger that would turn to life when he was around him, if you know that comic strip. But Calvin one day was bemoaning the fact. He said, I can just think of things a lot faster than I can say them. And Hobbes said, maybe that's so you can think twice before you talk. And I thought, that's exactly true. And we've got a lot of proverbs that talk about that. And people sometimes say, you need to count or you need to think. The point is the Bible, we could have made a whole lesson out of this in the book of Proverbs. The number of places that it tells us to be careful what we say and not to be hasty in our words. A fool doesn't give any thought. And I can give you another example, and I can tell you who has been guilty of this many times. He's standing up right now in this room. Have you ever done this? That you said something, and the instant it came out of your mouth, you thought, oops, I shouldn't have said that. I should have thought a little bit more before I said that. For whatever reason, you realize right then. And what that's saying is, you didn't. You were hasty in your words. We need to be very careful about this. When Jesus says, by our words we'll be justified and by our words we'll be condemned, that's serious, very serious. Don't be the person who says, well, whenever I think something, I always say it. Let me give you two other passages that sort of reaffirm this. And now going over the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 3 says, a fool's mouth is known by the multitude of words. What he's saying is a person who's always talking. I know some of us are very talkative. I don't think that's what this is talking about. But a person who never gives any thought, they're just constantly letting it all come out. Again, he's saying that's a fool. And back to Proverbs 10, verse 19. In the multitude of words, there wanteth not sin, but he who refraineth his lips is wise. So we're turning that coin over. We're talking about fools tonight. What that verse is saying is if you're a wise person, there'll be times when you'll think something and you'll think about it and you'll say, no, it's better not to say that. Silence sometimes is golden. And so that's a fool who's hasty in his words. Well, I don't want us to close tonight without looking at a couple of things from the New Testament that have to do with fools. So let's notice here, in Luke the 12th chapter, we often call this the rich fool, don't we? Let me read it to you. It's very short. Jesus spoke a parable saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do? Because I have no room where to bestow my fruits. And he said, this will I do. I will tear down my barns. I will build greater. And there I will bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease. Eat, drink, and be merry. I will never read this story. Now, I'll tell you the short version of this, too, as well. Without thinking about Danny. I went to high school with Danny. In fact, Danny's father was the principal of our high school. I liked Danny. He was a good friend of mine. He was one of the few people I've ever seen foul out of a basketball game in 3 minutes. But one thing about Danny that everybody knew was he was always talking about getting rich. Someday I'm going to be rich. That's all he could think about. Danny was able to find a job. He wasn't in the military, but he found a job working for some contractor over in Vietnam during the war. And he had it figured out. He was sending his money back to a stockbroker out there in Houston and wasn't having any expenses while he was over there. He was single and all that. But he had it planned out that he was going to be able to retire before he was 30 and be set for life financially. Unfortunately, a helicopter pad somehow or other slipped as they were moving it, fell on Danny and killed him. I went to Danny's funeral. And would you know the preacher in Danny's funeral said, "Danny always told us someday I'm going to be rich." And then he, of course, went on to say he is rich now, he's in heaven, so forth. But I always think about Danny because just like this man here, he was sure what his future was going to be and that he had everything taken care of to provide him with his material well-being. Now here's what God said to him as you have it on the chart up there. God said to him, "Thou fool, why? This night thy soul shall be required of thee. So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." Now this man made a lot of mistakes, one of which was obviously to presume he had a future that he didn't have. But Jesus is certainly not saying here that he was sinning because he happened to be prosperous. If you want to take that view, I can tell you most of the people in the world would look at everybody here tonight and say, "You're rich, you're prosperous." But what he's saying is, as Jesus explains it, he was rich, set up treasure for himself, but he wasn't rich toward God. What's that talking about? That's talking about materialism. Thinking that, you remember when we discussed in the class Sunday morning about the rich man and Lazarus? And notice that Jesus said, in fact, in this same context here in Luke 12, "A man's life consisteth not in the abundance of things he possesses." That's not what life's about. If you have more things, more ability to serve God, use it. Paul told Timothy to tell those who are rich, "Be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches." The folly here, one of the follies of this, and I think back to what Jesus said in the parable of the sower. One of the things that causes some not to be productive is the deceitfulness of riches. You ever think about that term? I know you've read it before. The deceitfulness of riches. I can think of two ways that riches are deceitful. One of them is to tell us or convince us that having enough of the things will make us happy. How many people that maybe you knew personally or well-known individuals have been extremely wealthy, but their lives were miserable? Maybe they even took their own life. So riches will convince us that will make us happy. Go read the book of Ecclesiastes and look for that idea. The second deceitfulness is that we think that's security. That's this man here. "You've got much laid up for many years. Take that easy. Drink me merry." He didn't have a future. He thought he did. "This night your soul will be required of you." And that's why Jesus would say in the Sermon on the Mount, "Not to lay up treasures on earth where moth and rust corrupt, thieves break through and steal." You ever thought about the irony of investments that are called securities? Talk to somebody who was around in 1929, 1930 about securities in investments. The fact is, it's deceitful. It won't necessarily make you happy. It's not anything you can depend on to last. It can be gone in a hurry. And so here was this man who's called, God calls him a fool. And the reason, the bottom line reason is he wasn't rich toward God. He didn't know what life was all about. He was only thinking in terms of material things. One last thing, and we'll let this do it for tonight. In one of Jesus' parables, as it's found in Matthew 25, very familiar parable, the parable of the 10 virgins. I'll just very briefly remind you. Here were these 10 virgins who were going to a wedding feast. And what we're told is 5 are wise and 5 were foolish. So here's our foolishness again. And then Jesus says the foolish one took no oil. So you remember they had their lamps with them. And the wise ones thought ahead and they took the oil they would need for their lamps when the bridegroom would come. The foolish ones didn't look ahead. They didn't make preparations. When the bridegroom came, they had to go buy some oil. They came back and the doors closed. And if you get the force of that imagery of Jesus, he's clearly talking about those who are not prepared for the Lord's return and judgment. And they're standing outside knocking and the door wasn't open. It was too late. Now let's get this last folly because I think it's one that needs to be impressed on people's minds. The ultimate fool is a person who has good intentions. This parable the five foolish virgins intended to go to the wedding ceremony, the feast. But they didn't get ready for it. And the world, there are many people who have no, again, they don't believe in God. They're that first fool we talked about. Or maybe they do, but they just really don't believe in all this religion stuff. But then there's a large number of people. If you were to ask them, they would probably, in a moment of sober reflection, they would say, well, yes, I know, I'm not ready. And I intend to get ready someday. I know I need to obey the gospel. Or I need to make these changes in my life. And I intend to do it someday. But as we're younger, as we get older, maybe more and more we lose that sense. But when we're younger, we feel like we've got a lot of time. Danny thought he had many years left in his life. So did this man we were just talking about. And here were these five foolish virgins. They were not prepared when the time came. And of course, obviously what Jesus is trying to impress upon us there in that story is that we need to be prepared for the time when he comes again. The warning here, let me see. Jesus said, watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour when the Son of Man cometh. We may not get home tonight. We may. We probably all, to be honest, expect that we will. We expect what we've got planned for tomorrow will happen, but it may not. We don't know. Jesus is saying, you don't know when I'm coming back again. I remember a number of years ago, I just happened to be vacationing in South Carolina, and they asked me to preach that morning, and I preached the whole sermon was about the parable of the virgins. And I tried to really make the point, and I did make the point, that if you knew for sure the Lord was coming at midnight tonight, God has told us we don't know the hour. Several places were told that. But if somehow it was revealed and you knew for certain Christ's second coming was going to happen at midnight tonight, and then all opportunities to be right were gone, would you want to change anything? You think about that. And if you really think about that, that can be sobering. That day in South Carolina, a young lady came forward and we baptized her. And after it's over, she said, that's what got me. Because I knew I wasn't ready. And it was terrifying to think if Christ should come today, what my eternal destiny would be. And the point Jesus is making here is, that's a fool. A fool who knows the truth and for whatever reason puts off obeying the truth, that's a fool. So let's know this. Let's don't be a fool. Do not be a fool. And that is a person who says there's no God. One who trusts in himself. One who makes a mock and thinks sin is funny. One who despises wisdom and won't take advantage of what God's given us along that line. One who spreads slander. One who despises father or mother. Loses his temper. Speaks in haste. Accumulates wealth but is not rich toward God. Or one who fails to prepare for eternity. Are any of those characters of yours in any degree? I hope tonight we'll be honest as we were examining ourselves going through this. And we know that we don't want to be a fool. If you find yourself in whatever degree in these things, be glad you had opportunity to learn about that, to think about it, and to correct it. If I should be talking to someone tonight who knows that you need to do something at this very moment to take advantage of the forgiveness of sins God made possible in Christ, and something you've allowed something to cause you to just keep putting it off, don't be a fool. Be wise tonight. Whatever your need might be, we urge you to come right now while we stand, while we sing.